Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. This morning, in this hour of the show, we will take up a topic that we have discussed here before on the program. We have done many shows on various kinds of health care topics, and we have physicians on the program to talk about particular things. We also have, from time to time, tried to talk about what is new in the world of prescription medications, and certainly there are new ones coming along all of the time. Many people take more than one, and people have questions about these medicines, what it is they do, potential side effects, things that they should think about. So from time to time, we have tried to build into the program an opportunity for people to ask those kinds of questions, and we will be doing that this morning. And we are happy to have with us as a guest, once again, James Rybacki. He is a pharmacist and author, someone who spends a lot of time writing about and talking about prescription drugs, trying to help people be more informed consumers and take better care of themselves. He's the editor of the Essential Guide to PrescriptionDrugs.com. Now, this is a website, and there's a lot of information there on prescription medicine. So you can go there and see what's available. He's a member of the clinical faculty at University of Maryland School of Pharmacy, is a guest lecturer and researcher at the Department of Family Medicine at Georgetown University School of Medicine. He's president of the Medicine Information Institute, which is based in Maryland, and provides drug information support and clinical pharmacy services to groups of doctors, to consumers, to employers, does a lot of seminars and does continuing education for people who have particular health concerns, things like diabetes and cardiovascular disease and osteoporosis and women's health. And in the course of doing this, he does a lot of interviews, and he's been with us before a number of times, and we're really pleased to have him here on the show once again to answer questions and to talk with us. So if you have a question, give us a call, 333-9455. Here, that's the number for Champaign Urbana. We have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And you can send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Whichever way you want to do it, I know that he will do his best to help you out. And we should say, Dr. Jim, hello. I'm pretty good. How are you doing?
Well, I'm freezing in Denver. I barely survived getting in through the snow via some help from Huskies and a shovel and a whisk broom that the rental car place put in my car. And I'm here to tell you, I'm shivering a little bit, but I've got a cup of coffee and willing and able to take some questions.
Well, that's good. Well, see, in our part of the country, the last month or so, it has been unusually warm, and that also feels very, I guess we shouldn't complain, but it feels a little odd. I don't know what the weather's been like in Baltimore over the last month or so.
It's actually been unusually warm, and the interesting part, they were telling, well, you know, Dr. Rybacki, it was in the 80s just a few days ago here in Denver, and I said, yeah. Why is there that little broom and everything in the car? And they say, oh, you might need it.
Be prepared. That's
who
right.
Knew? But, yeah, you know, at least I got my cardiovascular workout, shoveling the stuff out around the car and getting it out, and certainly got my heart rate up a little bit, and we all know we need to lose a little weight, so that's a good thing.
Excellent. Okay. Well, one of the things that I know that you would like to talk about is a new edition of the Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs, and this is one that it provides a lot of basic information to people, things to think about, whatever medicines they're taking, but it also has detailed information on these 12 medicines, or perhaps it's 11 and a mystery one.
It is.
And, you know, I was thinking, I looked at your list and I'm thinking, okay, so what is it about these things? And I went and I looked at lists of most prescribed drugs and the drugs that make the most money, you know, that are the most successful in terms of sales. And I'm thinking, well, okay, now some of those things or those classes of drugs are, in fact, on your list. What is it, though, that made you say, I want to concentrate for this book on these 11 things?
So the interesting thing is that I took an epidemiological sense, in the sense of what diseases usually bother most of us, which medicines may be more widely used but then have some sort of hidden side effects. I certainly took a look at top 200 or so medicines. You know, if you look at the Lipitor, Nexiums, and Plavix, Clopidogrels of the world, those certainly impact a lot of people. But there's also changes, and there's some competitors for some of these medicines. And so when you look at the older medicines, some of the blood thinners, those typically are relatively challenging to use, and they require ongoing monitoring. Yet there's a new family in the space. The new name and the new kid on the block is something called Rivaroxaban, and the brand name is Xarelto. And it sort of started out as, well, it's a blood thinner, it's an anticoagulant, and it then morphed into, well, we could probably use this in acute coronary syndromes and heart attacks and heart attack-like events. And then, more recently, it was found, well, you know, we could probably help pulmonary embolism, a blood clot in the lungs, and it looks like it's just going to be an emerging star. At the same time, I had to be a little bit tricky and somewhat sneaky in this one because I thought, well, let's make this a little bit different. And I frankly wrestled with the 12th medicine, and there's some very interesting things coming up for cancer, some very interesting things, some game changers coming up for cholesterol management. And there were some other things that are widely used that, frankly, I was considering alcohol, ethanol, as a, because it actually is prescribed for some antifreeze overdose sorts of uses. But we widely use it as an anti-anxiety agent. And gee, where's the profile that says, you know, we ought to be careful with that? And there have been some very high-profile people who have gotten into trouble combining prescription medicines with alcohol. And so I wrestled with that. And I thought, well, you know, June 12th is my birthday, so I will reveal some mystery medicine on June 12th on EssentialGuideToPrescriptionDrugs.com. And if you bought the book, you'll have a place to download that and say, yes, I bought the book, and there'll be a free newsletter that goes with that, too. Either I'm wrestling with that one a little bit, but either osteoporosis or weight loss, because both of those things are so topical. And I tell you, the medicines, though, they change so much. It's absolutely remarkable. And as you alluded to before, I honestly think if you brought aspirin before the FDA today, they'd say, okay, so the 81-milligram heart prevention aspirin, that's a prescription. And let's go with the 325 immediate pain release with some granules, that's a prescription. And you look at those, oh, you want it for fever, that's a prescription. And I really think that kind of thinking in the FDA is sort of characteristic now. There's a different, a somewhat more vigilant FDA. They're wrestling with actually have a whole division for drug shortages, and whoever comes into the administration in this election has a lot of work, as we know, in healthcare, because everybody wants the latest medicine, wants it to be totally free of side effects, and the reality is every medicine is a benefit-to-risk decision, even the ones that don't require a prescription, and you have to include herbal medicines and complementary care as well.
Yeah. Well, this, and I'm sure that this is a very, this presents a real problem for physicians in prescribing, because say you have a patient who has high blood pressure or has high cholesterol or, you know, any of the things that are very common now. So you want to treat that. So not only do you have a variety of potential medications that you have to choose from, but maybe something has come along and it's very new. So you're not quite sure about it. Because it's new, chances are it's probably expensive. There's not going to be a generic. So do you go with the newest thing? Do you go with the most tried and true thing? Do you try to save your patient some money and prescribe the generic? How is a physician to wade through all those choices?
And so if you look at that, and those are so many of the consults I get, nobody ever says, hey, you know what, I have an uncomplicated strep throat. What would you use? It's always, well, you know, I've got this patient who's had muscle aches and pains from three different statins, and their cholesterol is this, and they're also diabetic, and they've got high blood pressure. And what do you think about this new one on the block, and what about that generic? So in sorting those out, it's always, how do you try to match the power of the medicine to the severity of the problem? For example, if you look at somebody who has a little bit of elevated cholesterol, it may be possible to manage that small elevation, providing their good cholesterol, HDL, is normal, but that small LDL with a red rice yeast or something like that, which is actually a complementary care product, it's probably going to work. And if you get a well-formulated product, a lot of physicians will say, well, you know, if you want to start something like that, we need a reliable company. Let's set a time frame on it. Let's look at 3 months in your next follow-up. Let's recheck those labs. And if we get to those goals, that might be a place to start. But if you've got a diabetic patient and you've got a much higher cholesterol and you've got an HDL that's too low, then a prescription medicine may only be the way to go. And so then if you look at that particular group, that particular family of medicines, and you start thinking about Crestor, Lipitor, Zocor, and Livalo, well, Livalo is the newest one. That's pitavastatin. And it looks like that one probably increases good cholesterol the most. If you look at Zocor, that's probably the oldest one and the least expensive one. And if you look at Crestor and Lipitor, they have probably the latest data saying, yeah, it looks like that they, and they're the ones that have been studied like that, they're the ones that probably reverse, if you take these for a couple of years, some of the clogging of arteries. And so you have to balance all of that with the particular patient, which with what they've tolerated in the past. And I threw in the diabetes issue because one of the things that's in the new 12 top meds for 2012 is actually that potential increase in blood sugar that these statins can cause. And still, the benefit clearly outweighs the risk of that increase in blood sugar, but you have to watch it now. And the FDA actually did a release on that, I want to say the end of February, but if our listeners go to FDA.gov and put in safety changes for cholesterol-lowering drugs, that should get them the release. And they basically, I made up a mnemonic. I love mnemonics, and the mnemonic to remember that is BLID. And what that stands for is brain, in the sense of some patients have had some changes in their thinking, a somewhat foggy sort of approach, I think, is a way to describe it. The liver monitoring has basically been a recommendation since these came on the market, and the FDA relaxed those sort of monitorings because it wasn't really found to be fruitful. There are some interactions in the sense of other medicines. I've detailed those in the Essential Guide, but some of the medicines that are actually transplant medicines you have to watch in combination, and some things, antifungals, some of the azole antifungals, you have to be very careful with in combination, and actually those should not be combined. And then lastly, of course, the changes in sugar, which started to come up when large studies were done, because these things are still, they're rare effects. It seems like it may be up to 9% in some populations, but it's something that your doctor has to look out for, and I think that argues for good follow-up with your doctor and clear targets, because you've got to set a target if you're going to start a medicine.
Our guest in this hour is Dr. James Rabacki. He's a doctor of pharmacy. He's the editor of the Essential Guide to PrescriptionDrugs.com, which is a website where you find a lot of information on medicines. For many, many years, he edited this book, and there was a new edition every year, which is called the Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs. And then at one point, he really moved over and started to do this more as a thing that existed electronically, and now you can go to Amazon, for example, and you can look at the books that he's done in recent years that are available for the Kindle and that concentrate on particular kinds of medicines for particular health issues. And his new book is The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs, 12 Top Meds for 2012. And we have a caller here who's been patient with us, so we'll get right to them. This is someone who is in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Yes, hello. I'm a almost 75-year-old woman.
You sound great.
Well, voice, you can't tell. But when I open my kitchen cabinet, all my medications fall out, and I'm really appalled at how many I take.
I'm going to come to your house and help you. Oh my gosh. Don't be appalled at how many you take. The thing I would ask first is, do you look at them every half a year to make sure they're in date?
Oh, yeah. I keep it. There's eight that I take regularly.
Okay.
I'm probably about 7 pounds overweight. I do like...
I'm about 10.
That's all right. I like to exercise, so I'm not, not a couch potato.
Just
had some back problems, disc problems, and I was on my back for a month, and I was on Vicodin. I was in a total fog, but I just wonder if there's anyone I could go to and say, Can you look at all of these? I was having some confusion recently, and we sort of took. I'm bipolar, and it's under great control. And then I have my doctor. But I just wondered when I sat in the car one day and I didn't know what to turn on next. I thought, this is not right. I'm confused. But my bottom line is, is there someone like you go to a nutritionist who looks at all your nutrition, and you go to a person, you know, a trainer and so on. Is there someone, because we have so many doctors involved, that can look at all of them and say, you know, I don't think these go well together. I'm assuming that Walgreens keeps an eye on, you know, whether there are drug reactions. But I just don't like the idea of that excess.
So there should be someone overall looking at all of the medicines you take. Some pharmacies and Walgreens in some areas is one of them, actually offers what's called a brown bag session periodically.
Okay.
And you can bring in all your medicines and we'll take a look at it. And certainly, wherever you get your medicines, they should be every time checking for drug interactions with all of the medicines, prescription, non-prescription, and herbal that you take.
Yeah.
But you mentioned a very potent one, and when you look at Vicodin, for our listeners, that's hydrocodone plus acetaminophen, which we know is Tylenol.
Right.
So it's a potent morphine-like kind of combination, pretty strong medicine. And that certainly can, along with any other more potent pain medicines, can cause some changes in thinking. But
oh, no, this was before that. That I was confused. And I went to the pharmacist and talked to her, and I said, you know, your doctor doesn't like you to come back and say, I talked to the pharmacist, and she thinks this might be causing some confusion. They just don't like that. That's my feeling.
Right. And so see if there's, if you go on the web and actually search pharmacotherapy analysis or medicine optimization, sometimes you'll get some clinical pharmacists, some doctors of pharmacy who offer those kind of services.
Okay.
I'm actually here in Denver acting as a medicine concierge with a pain management overlaid on an asthma patient and trying to figure out how to get all those things done without stopping breathing, which is sort of a bad day. And so, of course, that's what you want to try to get. Any pharmacist can help you with that. The way to ask that is some of them are offering cognitive services. Some of them are also offering collaborative care. That's something that I do in Maryland, and actually I get some questions around the country. But what I'll have is a physician call me up and say, you know, geez, Jim, we've been through 16 of these different medicines, and Lucille seems to have these reactions to these particular kinds of things, yet we still have to manage these four problems. You know, what do you think? And I've actually developed something of a word-of-mouth clientele with that. Mm-hmm. But it's important to get someone who really has the background and understands that and can not only run a drug interactions check, but a drug food, a drug disease, and a drug eliminations check. Because whatever goes in there, you know, if you start putting too many medicines that are all using the liver to get out, they all sort of block each other, and they're all trying to get into the same taxi, so you have to be careful. But a good review is always smart, and you should always involve your doctor in that as well. And if he or she doesn't really like what the pharmacist says, well, you know, it might be this or that, you say, well, you know what, I want to balance an objective overview, and I think they're doing a good job. So I would take that back.
I mean, do you think an average of 8 medicines plus vitamins and is a lot for
people? If you look at people in the 7th or 8th decade of life, it's not unusual to have 4 or 5 different medical problems and 1 or 2 medicines for each of them. And if I multiply 4 times 2 in my head, I think I get 8. David will have to correct me here. And so in that sense, adding the vitamins and the other complementary care issues, I think, is a slam dunk home run. I hope you have some omega-3s in there. There's some tremendous data that came out in the journal Neurology about omega-3 fatty acids, and getting a well-formulated kind is very important. But it looks like over time, people who ate more fish and or took some supplements.
Yeah, I bought those krill.
And krill has a component of that, right. You want to make sure, if you look at the active ingredients, it's EPA, that's Edward Paul Alpha, and DHA, David Harvey Anna. and it's, you know, icosapentaenoic acid. I hate to even say that on air, but, you know, if you have about 200 milligrams of EPA and maybe 700 of DHA, those are probably the more potent kinds, and those are the things to look for. But what they found is that actually preserved thinking over time and actually kept your brain about the same size. I mean, my wife has said I have a small brain many times, and now I say, well, honey, I'm taking omega-3s.
Well, see, that would be two more I put in the cupboard today.
But in the sense of...
I mean, I look at my friends, and they're saying, I go somewhere, you're taking all of those? Yeah.
Well, and so, when you look at that, there's elegant pharmacotherapy that sometimes can treat two medicines with a single pill, and you can certainly express that to your doctor and say, you know, I'm worried about this. It's called polypharmacy, and you know, the old articles on that were, well, when the disease becomes a pill and the pill becomes a disease, and there was sort of that flipping in logic. But the bottom line is, if you're remembering to take them all and they're all treating a current problem, that makes sense. If you're not, and if there are some other side effects that you're experiencing, then those should be reviewed. And that's the time to sit down and have a very strong meeting with somebody like me and say, hey, what do you think?
All right.
Great question.
Champagne. We'll have a meeting.
We'll
get a bunch of people. Okay, well, thanks.
All right, thank you.
Oh, you bet. Take good care.
Let us continue, and we'll talk next with somebody else in Champaign. This is line number 2.
It's the Champaign line.
Yeah, I guess it is. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Yeah, I was interested in hearing your comments about the dominance and of the pharmaceutical industry and in research and development of medications, and then in the promoting of medications to physicians and the public.
Okay.
And so it just seems to me, when you have, for example, let's take psychiatric medications,
uh-huh.
more and more and younger children being diagnosed as bipolar and being placed on medications long-term, chronically, all right, psychiatric medications, for which there's very little or no scientific evidence. But what the pharmaceutical companies do is they put someone big, like, you know, someone from Harvard University, some pediatric psychiatrist, neurologist or whatever, somebody with a bunch of titles and who runs in some prestigious program, and they fund his research, you know, to the tune of millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes around speaking about these drugs, you know, and basically promoting them. And, you know, they, you know, before you have the talk to the primary care physicians and everybody else, he discloses, yeah, you know, we receive grants from here and here, you know, for a minute there's a brief ethical moment of disclosure, but still the impact is to put more and more people on more and more drugs, and I really think there's a problem with over-prescription, you know, of antidepressants, over-prescription of statins, people who really don't need them. I don't think a whole lot of thought goes into the actual risk factors in the office. I think the office time is so limited that, you know, physicians without much thought, they look at the numbers and the patient comes in and they put them on the latest statin that the drug rep, you know, left as samples or gave them pens or some other bribe.
Yeah, let's...
That's where I would like to hear your comment on,
sure.
on the inordinate, you know, and it leads to huge problems. You know, 1 in 5, 1 in 4 hospitalizations for people, you know, to the hospital is because of a bad drug problem.
And
medications, okay?
And so certainly there's actually some data about that, about some 100,000 deaths in the U.S. from medication misadventures and or side effects. So the question, and what you're largely bringing up, I think, is one. I was an interim health system director at UT Southwestern in Dallas, and at academic centers, it's really very, very stringent, and that's just one that I have direct experience with. And the point of the pens and the potential conflict of interest it seems like an innocent thing to take a pen, and actually that has all changed now. So pharmaceutical companies are not allowed to hand out branded pens, and so that doesn't happen anymore. The idea that someone has gotten a grant from a particular company to do some research, there's a very large group in this country called the National Institutes of Health, and a couple colleagues of mine have somewhat large NIH grants, and there's an independence there. The American Heart Association has had a pharmaceutical roundtable that's been dissolved, and there was some grant money there. And there was a hands-off, rigorous science approach to those kinds of things. That's very different from someone who may have done some quote-unquote research with 20 or 30 demonstration patients and have received a grant for it, and then are doing speeches around the country or around the region about particular medicines. It's never okay to bend the science. And when any clinician, physician, pharmacist, nurse practitioner looks at a particular patient, the question has to be the history, the numbers, the prognosis over time. And, you know, I'm here to tell you, looking at the guidelines, and I know the people who do the guidelines, for example, the cholesterol guidelines and the upcoming probably third quarter of this year, cholesterol guidelines will change things. The high blood pressure guidelines have been delayed. They'll probably also be out this year as well. And what the guidelines are leaning towards is earlier therapy, earlier intervention. And what we see now is pre-diabetes and pre-hypertension. And I'm here to tell you that when you think about this, this isn't just a little blood pressure. It is a, and I'm sorry to do that to your ears, it is a pounding on the inner lining of your blood vessels. It's nothing less than that. And that's what high blood pressure does. So the treatment paradigms have come out to say, you know, we need to start treatment earlier. We need to start looking at cholesterol management earlier. And I actually am an example of someone who is being managed by a tremendous clinician at an academic center for my cholesterol, and had relatively unremarkable numbers, relatively normal HDL and just a little bit out of range LDL. And thank God I wrote a book called Medicines in Your Family, and some of those clinicians insisted that I put the really minor symptoms of a heart attack on it because I had one, because the aggressive treatment that was needed, the follow-up, the setting of targets, the earlier therapy wasn't done in my case, despite a pretty strong family history. And so it may appear that things are being treated earlier, and in fact, in a guideline-driven sense, they are. When you cross over into bipolar affective disorder and look at depression, some of those particular categories and some of the diagnosis and statistical manuals that are coming out have received a little bit of controversy in the sense of how they look. There's actually some information about that on EssentialGuideToPrescriptionDrugs.com. But the other side of that balance is that people who really have bipolar disorder have what are really pathological mood swings, and from mania to depression, and that's uncomfortable. Where there is strong science and the medicines that are being used to treat that, there can be tremendous relief, but the clinician has to stay on top of it. And those pills, combined with some ongoing counseling and that sort of talk therapy, if you will, are certainly sort of the state of the art right now.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Dr. Jim Rybacki. He's a pharmacist. He's editor of the Essential Guide to PrescriptionDrugs.com. That's a website, also for many years, authored a book on that subject with information on a wide range of very commonly used prescription medicines. We'll talk some more after a very short break. This is Focus.
WILL programs are made possible by the Champaign-Urbana Symphony, presenting Classics 4, Struggles and Triumphs, on Saturday, April 14th at 7:30 p.m. in the Fullinger Great Hall at Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. The symphony completes its season with works by Rachmaninoff and Shostakovich.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings, 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. We always welcome questions, comments. In the second hour today, our guest will be Mike Lapham. He is involved with an organization known as United for Fair Economy. He works in their Responsible Wealth Project, and he is the co-author of a book that we'll be talking about. The title of his book is The Self-Made Myth. And the truth about how government helps individuals and businesses succeed. And this takes on an idea that they call the self-made myth, the idea that for people who are really successful, that it was just about exclusively the result of their own work. And they make the argument, and if you talk to some very successful people, they will tell you that along the line, other people helped them, and that there are, in fact, things that government does that indeed can help people succeed. So we'll talk more about that in the second hour of the show. You can check our website and find out what we'll do in the days ahead. Listen to past programs. It's WILL.illinois.edu. You can also find us on Twitter at Will Public Media. This is Focus, our morning talk show. We're talking this morning about prescription medicines, and our guest is Dr. Jim Rybacki. He's the editor of the Essential Guide to PrescriptionDrugs.com, member of the clinical faculty at University of Maryland School of Pharmacy. He's president of the Medicine Information Institute, which is based in Maryland, and provides drug information support and clinical pharmacy services to groups of doctors, to consumers, to employers. He gives seminars and education meetings on specific diseases like diabetes, cardiovascular disease, osteoporosis, women's health, and does a lot of public speaking and interviewing. And we're pleased to have him here. Also, if you're interested, you can find the most recent iteration of his book. It's The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs, 12 Top Meds for 2012. So it has specific information on medicines, but also has some more general information on things that people should be thinking about no matter what medicines that you might be taking. And questions, welcome. We have a couple of people ready to go here. We'll try to get in as many as we can. I also have a couple of emails we want to try to do. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we will go back to the phones here and talk next with somebody in Champaign County on our line 3. Hello.
Hi. I'm glad that general topics have been aired, but maybe another time. I have maybe two specific questions, and one of them is about pain relief medicines related to neuralgia and neuropathy. Just had a bout of shingles and mild case, they say. I don't know what a bad case is like. I want to know. I had the vaccine in August and still came down with some. But
that's probably why you had a mild case.
Yeah, and that's what they say, and yep. I'm glad for that. But gabapentin, I know a person who has had a lot of problems, and she just could not abide with it in 3 days because of its mood-altering sort of. I understand sure. It's also used for mood stabilization and in people with psychiatric problems, and it's also used originally for. But I just wanted to talk generally about it. I ended up using a combination of neurotriptyline, which is an antidepressant, but
it is
discovered to have the be specific for neuropathy as well. A general comment, I wonder whether amputation, phantom pain, that probably is a category of neuropathy. So if you want to generalize and talk about that.
Oh my gosh! So we're going to hit the whole nervous system here. You're a challenging caller, but no, and your questions are very well founded. Looking at a postherpetic neuralgia. What that says is, for our listeners, is that that's pain that happens after you have had, shingles. And that can be such an incredible pain. Some patients have required morphine-like compounds, and this is an example. The vaccine can actually give you some lesser case of that if you're going to get it. And so the challenge then is how to manage it. The interesting part is that if you look at pain management and you go from the sort of weaker over-the-counter pain medicines, the Anacins, Vanquish, Tylenol, leave naproxen, Motrins of the world, those are probably like a 1 to 2 on a pain scale in relief and last variable amounts of times. The next groups are sort of the Celebrexes and Ultrams and Lorsets and the Vicodin that a caller mentioned earlier. And then you get up to the more serious kinds of medicines, Percocet, OxyContin, Duragesic, fentanyl, MS-Contin, and sometimes post-herpetic neuralgia is so painful, and our caller, I think, alluded to that a little bit, that can be just an overwhelming pain requiring very much scheduled high-potency medicines and then requiring something for constipation and the whole gamish of things to get control of that pain, because you don't want to be a chronic pain patient. And so one of the things your body does, there's actually something called neuronal plasticity that has been built into our nervous systems by a higher power who always fascinates me. And what that means is that if you actually let pain continue, or if it's not treated well, you can release some damaging neurotransmitters, glutamate, and some other compounds like that, and you can actually rewire the nervous system. So you can actually have pain where it doesn't make sense because you would think, knowing the neuroanatomy, it shouldn't go there. So enter different kinds of medicines, and that's where the gabapentins, antidepressants come in. And surprisingly, there's a tremendous amount of data looking at tricyclic antidepressants, looking at nortriptyline and medicines like that, that actually are used, and I hate to use the word, I don't mean it as a derogatory phrase, but they're used as cocktails. So a combination of a stronger primary pain medicine, something, you know, like a perhaps Vicodin, but Ultran, Celebrex, those sorts of things may be used. And then it's interesting, gabapentin is actually, when you look at it, a somewhat older medicine now. Pregabalin is the somewhat newer one, but there were some studies that were done, about 500 patients or so with gabapentin, looking at what they call PHN, or post-herpetic neuralgia, and it seems to be reasonably effective in some patients. Now, of course, there's always that benefit to risk. The studies, as I remember, were a couple months long, and gabapentin is one of those medicines that typically, and I've actually used that in chronic pain patients as part of a multi-specialty pain clinic, it's one of those medicines that typically gets started in smaller doses, 300, 100, something like that, and then it's slowly increased, what your doctor or clinical pharmacist would say is titrated to usually about 600 to 1,200 milligrams to pain relief. And the balance in that is that there can be some changes in thinking, and it varies tremendously from patient to patient. And so just like when you're trying to pick an antidepressant for a particular patient, some patients do very, very well. The older medicines would be an example on a nortriptyline and something like that. And others require a Lexapro, something like a newer kind of selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor to get the benefit just because of the way their nerves are wired. And so it becomes an ongoing trial and succession of different therapeutics, and it's not unusual at all to have combinations of therapy. I hope the caller's pain is getting better. That tends to abate over time, and then hopefully now you have enough antibodies you won't have another recurrence.
Yeah, I'm off this stuff now, and it's been helpful. I still get occasionally these cramping effects, and which aren't pain, but are just really annoying.
Yep. Well, sure. And you know, when you look at that, you brought up an amazing thing. When you think of a phantom limb, it's like, well, my God, the nerves are no longer there. The leg part is gone, yet you're still having pain. And so some of the original things for that were actually beta blockers, looking at sort of those transmitters. And then there were some other kinds of combinations of medicines that were used. And that's, a very difficult thing to try to treat.
Yeah.
The post-herpetic neuralgia is actually a damage from the virus itself, and boy, remarkably painful. I'm glad you had a mild case.
We have just about 10-12 minutes left. I
guess
other folks. I'm glad that we can try at least to give some reasonably thorough answers to people's questions. One thing I want to try to get
that
in
deserves
here,
one.
this someone has emailed this question.
Okay.
They're interested in alternatives for ibuprofen or other non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs that don't hurt your stomach. Does such a thing
yep.
exist, they ask.
And so when you look at that, the challenge is that the medicines are stupid. And when you look at COX-1 versus COX-2 inhibitors, and you look at something that still is a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, well, surprise, surprise, I just mentioned it. If you want to talk to your doctor about something that is in that non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug family, there still is one. It's actually Celebrex. Celecoxib is a COX-2 inhibitor, and part of the benefit of that, part of the selectivity of that, is that it's supposed to be easier on your stomach. And, you know, having said that, the one people think about before is Vioxx or Rofecoxib, which was taken off the market because of some side effects. Mm-hmm. And Celecoxib or Celebrex appears to avoid that. But there's lots of different pain medicines, and it's always an interesting combination. Certainly, if you look at adding Celebrex, there's no reason you can't add acetaminophen or Tylenol onto that. That's going to a different family. It's a pure pain reliever and avoids that NSAID combination. But if you put those two together, you can get a little bit more beneficial pain relief, which, of course, is the important thing in pain management.
Okay, let's go to Sydney for another caller. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I am curious about the...
I'm having a little trouble hearing.
Okay, well, we'll go off...
Oh, that's better. That's better.
I'm curious about the time periods involved in the steps when a drug goes from animal studies that look promising to the human trials. My interest is in the news out of Case Western about bexarotene. So they had success after a three-month trial with mice. They're playing with different formulations or dosages, et cetera. So from your experience, I imagine that there is an application process and then approval to do the human trial, and then I imagine there's a number of red tape steps. So could you just kind of run through that?
Sure.
And is it a 6 month, 1 year, or 3 year, 5 year time period?
And boy, is that a an interesting question. The short answer is it depends. Where our listeners can go is to www.fda.gov and just search this FDA approval process. So in general, what happens is that you have to think about the medicines themselves and what can happen for very novel medications is there's an FDA fast track designation. Those usually happen for what are called novel molecular entities, NMEs. And so that sort of makes it the shortest possible time frame. That could be 8 months, maybe a year. And that's if the FDA recognizes a medicine as something that new, that's obviously a shorter time frame. Generally, the steps are phase one, phase two, phase three, phase four. Phase one is basically animals. Phase two starts to look at doses that work in humans. There's a 2A and a 2B, and in there you start looking at patients who actually have the disease or condition versus healthy college students or otherwise want to volunteer for pharmacodynamic or pharmacokinetic studies. And phase three is where you're actually looking at larger number and FDA-defined populations of patients who have a particular disease. So the answer is, how long does it take? Well, if you have to get 1,500 patients who have melanoma, for example, and have metastatic melanoma as a secondary, and our listeners can also go to www.clinicaltrials.gov to see different clinical trials. But if you have to get a larger number of patients with a somewhat more narrowly defined problem, then it's going to take longer to get them. It's called accretion. And so it may be many years to actually bring a medicine to market. And the interesting thing that the FDA appears to be doing now is actually requiring some post-marketing studies. There is a new weight loss medicine called Cunexa that's before the FDA now that may actually get a yay or nay as early as, I believe, April 17th. But there may actually be not only a REMS, a risk evaluation and mitigation strategy to go along with it, but there may be some continuation of studies because the FDA is taking a longer, more careful look at the medicines. Now, having said all of that, it's always an adventure, and what we want is the latest medicine, but the FDA has to try to keep us safe.
Okay, again, I hope that helps the caller. We'll try to get at least one more caller in here.
Please, we'll go
to Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, my question, I'm not sure how much time you have to really give a full answer, but I'm curious about the cutting edge of psychopharmacology not being able to get a full answer. Maybe if you could just give one example of an interesting new psychopharmacokinetic drug, I would love to hear about that.
Okay. Well, Jim, can you do that?
Well, yeah. So if you look at that, there's pretty good, there's a Pacific Neuropsychiatric Institute, PNI.org, that actually deals with psychopharmacology. I think that's such a broad topic. Basically, what you see from the American Psychiatric Association are some pretty good journals looking at translational and interdisciplinary science on psychopharmacology that also overlaps into drug abuse. There are some fascinating compounds moving along, and as far as the specifics and where you may look, I would just go to ASCPP.org, that's the American Society of Clinical Pharmacology, Psychopharmacology, sorry, and that should get you all of the latest information you could even read in 12 weeks.
We're coming here. We have maybe about 5 minutes. There's an email here I'd like to ask you about, and I'm not sure if this is enough time to deal with it, but I'll try and see what have to say here. The person is interested in whether you can talk about whether there is any significant interaction issues between Sporinox and lorazepam, and perhaps in addition, this person says they're taking Zoloft. They take 200 milligrams of Zoloft each day, and perhaps they're interested in anything general you might want to say about Zoloft.
No, we weren't sure. It was Sporinox.
Sporinox and lorazepam.
Okay. And so when you look at that, Sporinox is one of those antifungal medicines, and that can change the way drugs are metabolized. And so I would ask that person if they actually talked over or actually brought their prescriptions to a pharmacist, because that's one of those things looking at sertraline, and one of the first questions was Seldane and trifenidine and antifungals, and there's a question of an interaction there. So that's something that they should talk to their pharmacist about. And if they haven't started the Sporinox, the question is how much of a level, how much are they taking? And you want to be careful about those sorts of combinations, just because they can interfere with the antifungal drugs tend to get added on for a different reason. And so you might not have someone looking at all of the combinations there, and so if they haven't started the Sporinox, they need to talk to their doc, whoever got that for them before they combine it, and certainly they can talk to their pharmacist about that.
Okay. Another thing that this person was interested in specifically, whether there was any problem with having, since they take this Zoloft, whether there was any risk in occasionally taking Imitrex for migraines while you're taking the Zoloft.
Okay, so yeah, so that's, boy, they're coming up with all the big ones here. When you look at Imitrex and that whole family of medicines, and you try to figure out what can happen with that, I would encourage them, again, to go back to whoever prescribed that, as that's one of those things where there can be an interaction, and you just have to be careful.
Yeah, okay. Well, that I think that just goes back to, in fact, the very first question we had, that if people are taking multiple medications, they certainly should be at least sensitive to the fact that there can be interaction issues. So that's something that you want to discuss with somebody. Either you want to talk about it with your pharmacist, you want to talk about it with you if you have a family practice or family medicine doctor, someone who has the overview of everything that you're taking, who can watch out for the possibility that there might be some interactions.
Someone clearly has to be driving that bus. And, you know, when you look at that, for an Imitrex is a good example as well. So sumatriptan and Xanax and Zoloft, and when you look at all those combinations, they can interact. The question is the degree and the severity and what the doses are. And there's actually they're usually major, minor, and sort of intermediate. There's a major drug interaction between the Imitrex and Zoloft. So that says to me either that's a question where somebody was thinking hypothetically, or no one has actually taken an overall look at that person's medicines, and they need to.
Yeah. The one of the big things that people are very concerned about, obviously, is the high cost of prescription medicines.
Oh, sure.
And so for that reason, some doctors either may be prescribing generics or maybe individuals are thinking, well, would I be able to save some money if I used a generic? And clearly not everything is available as a generic. But I think a lot of people have this question, well, you know, it's supposed to be the same. As far as the FDA says, it's the same. But people, I'm sure, have this experience. They say, well, you know, I took a brand name medicine and then I took a generic and it wasn't the same. How do you think about using generics?
Well, wherever possible, I do in my own life. And so there are actually some, if you look at the Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs and those 12 top meds for 2012, well, clopidogrel or Plavix will probably have a generic out in May. Lexapro or escitalopram, looking at a generic as well. Diavan, Valsartan, high blood pressure medicine, coming generic as well. And so the FDA really takes a hard look at those things. And some of what I hear from patients sometimes are somewhat subjective differences in perceived benefits. And by gosh, you know, there's a placebo pill. If I tell you, David, you know, this little sugar pill I have here, without telling you it's a sugar pill, is the most powerful pain medicine to come along, I'll get a response in about 63 or higher percent of the Davids that I give it to because of that placebo effect. And so when you look at subjective things like mood, like relative pain effects, your mind works an amazing group of ways on that. If you look at cholesterol medicines and you go to a generic Lipitor, which atorvastatin, which just became generic. Well, I'll tell you what, Sparky, you can go to the lab, get those blood tests drawn, and you will know that generic Lipitor is having the same effect that the brand did, and the benefit is to your cholesterol, to your life, and to those unclogging arteries.
Right. We're going to have to leave it at that.
Okay.
Our guest, James Rybacki, he's editor of the Essential Guide to PrescriptionDrugs.com. You can find him on the web. A lot of good information there. Also, the new book is The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs, 12 Top Meds for 2012. Jim, thanks very much.
My pleasure. I'm going to go back out and shovel some snow.
All right. Good luck with that.